From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Porque se acaben las confrontaciones.
For the unity of our country, so that the clashes end.
Bolivia recupere su normalidad.
So that Bolivia can recover its normality, and so that the experience we've lived through in our country may never be repeated.
Sea repetida. Renuncio.
I resign the succession as mandated by Article 93 of the State Political Constitution.
De la Constitución Política del Estado.
Following massive protests, the right-wing president of the Bolivian Senate ends his attempt to take over the country. Instead, the head of the Supreme Court will talk about the future of Bolivian politics and the mass indigenous rebellion with Bolivian activist Marcela Oliveira.
I don't think that change a man who is the head of our government is the solution for the problems that we have right now.
And as indigenous uprisings steer South America in a new direction, we'll have a debate on the U.S.-backed Central American Free Trade Agreement between veteran anti-sweatshop activist Charles Kernighan and Nicaragua's chief CAFTA negotiator, Carlos Sequeira.
CAFTA is about joint development. CAFTA is good business for the United States and Central America and the Dominican Republic.
And we'll also hear from Charlie Kernighan.
The workers in Central America tell us that they're worse off now than they were 2 or 3 years ago. They're falling deeper into misery. Their wages are actually falling. They have absolutely no rights. And if they suspect the workers are even trying to organize, they're fired and blacklisted.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After weeks of rebellion led by indigenous protesters, Bolivia has a new president. At 11:47 last night, the president of Bolivia's Supreme Court was sworn in after a day marked by massive protest and widespread fears of a bloodbath or civil war. The situation in Bolivia remains tense, but many believe the worst-case scenario has been avoided. Throughout the day Thursday, the right-wing head of the Bolivian Senate, Armando Vacadillas, was maneuvering behind the scenes and in public to take control of Bolivia. Meanwhile, indigenous leaders and other opposition groups vowed to bring Vacadillas down by force if necessary, if he took power. Earlier this week, President Carlos Mesa resigned amid massive protest against his government, giving Vacadillas an opportunity to take power as his constitutional successor. After resigning, Mesa joined opposition calls for Vacadillas and the Speaker of the House to step aside and allow the president of the Supreme Court to assume the presidency and organize elections. But throughout Thursday, Vacadillas seemed bent on rejecting those calls and was said to be negotiating with the military. In order to take over, Vacadillas needed to convene the Congress, which he could not do in La Paz because of the massive protests. Thursday, he moved lawmakers to the historical capital, Sucre, in an attempt to meet. Again, protests prevented that from happening until late last night. Before that meeting happened, Vacadillas was taken by the military to a secure base where he announced he would not seek the presidency. After a tense day in which one protest leader was killed and rumors floated of a possible coup d'etat, Eduardo Rodriguez was sworn in. After taking the oath of office, the Harvard graduate briefly addressed the country.
Democracy and the sense of union and peace is the best destination for Bolivians.
Bolivia's new president, Eduardo Rodriguez, sworn in at 11:47 last night. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. Congressmember John Conyers of Michigan has announced as ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, he's scheduled hearings on the so-called Downing Street memo and what Conyers calls the administration's efforts to cook the books on pre-war intelligence. The hearing's scheduled for June 16th. Conyers also says he plans to introduce new documents that back up the accuracy of the Downing Street memo, which is actually the classified minutes of a July 2002 meeting of Tony Blair and his senior advisors. The minutes paint a picture of an administration that had already committed to attacking Iraq, was manipulating intelligence, and had already begun bombing Iraq to prepare for the ground invasion. This was almost a year before the actual invasion began. In a statement released yesterday, Conyers said next Thursday's hearing will attempt to answer what he calls serious constitutional questions raised by these revelations. Among those scheduled to testify are former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Joe Wilson, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, Cindy Sheehan, who lost her son in Iraq, and attorney John Boniface, who's been calling for President Bush's impeachment. Congressmember Conyers says immediately following the hearings, he'll deliver a petition to the White House signed by over 500,000 people. The petition demands Bush answer questions about his secret plan for the Iraq invasion. A newly released Justice Department report says the FBI missed at least five opportunities before the September 11th attacks to uncover what it calls vital intelligence information about the alleged hijackers. The report by the department's inspector general says the Bureau didn't aggressively pursue the information it did have. The report blames the FBI for not knowing about the presence of two of the alleged hijackers in the U.S. and for not following up on an agent's theory that Osama bin Laden was sending students to U.S. flight training schools. The report is a year old and is only now being released because of a court fight with lawyers for accused 9/11 conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said Thursday, Democrats will not allow a vote on President Bush's nominee for UN ambassador unless the White House hands over records of communications intercepts John Bolton sought from the National Security Agency. Reid told CNN, quote, if they want Bolton as ambassador to the United Nations, give us this information. If they don't, there will be no Bolton. Senators Joe Biden and Christopher Dodd have demanded the Bush administration produce 10 National Security Agency communication intercepts that Bolton requested since 2001 as the State Department's undersecretary for arms control. Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers are once again threatening to cut U.S. funding of the United Nations. The International Relations Committee of the House of Representatives this week approved a sweeping bill that, if passed, would require Washington to withhold funds if the U.N. doesn't alter several of its policies. The bill would require the U.N. to fund most of its programs through voluntary contributions rather than mandatory dues from its 191 member states and enable Washington to pick and choose those programs it wished to fund. It would also require the UN to set up a number of new oversight boards to investigate the UN bureaucracy and specific agencies, as well as adopt new rules that would bar governments Washington opposes from serving on the UN Human Rights Commission. It would also withhold U.S. support for new or expanded U.N. peacekeeping operations until specific reforms are implemented. Failure to implement any of the specific mandates would result in the withholding of half the assessed U.S. obligations, which amount to $438 million this year. The bill is expected to be introduced to the full House next week. Now to the fight for freedom of the media. A former co-chair of the Republican National Committee is the leading candidate to take over the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That is the U.S. taxpayer-funded agency that funds public media in this country. Patricia DeStacy Harrison is reportedly the favored candidate of the CPB's chairman, Kenneth Tomlinson. Harrison is currently a high-ranking official at the State Department. She was co-chair of the RNC from 1997 to January 2001, helping to raise money for Republican candidates, including George W. Bush. In her State Department role, Harrison has praised the work of the department's Office of Broadcasting Services, which in early 2002 began producing feature reports, some coordinated by the White House, that promoted the administration's arguments for the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. The reports were distributed free to domestic and international TV stations. In testimony before Congress last year, Harrison said the Bush administration regarded these, quote, good news segments as powerful strategic tools for swaying public opinion. Lawyers for deposed Iraqi President Saddam Hussein say they have not been formally given any of the charges against the former leader and say they have not been given access to any of the estimated 8 million documents relating to the case, despite the fact that Iraqi officials have announced his trial could begin in 60 days. Saddam Hussein has been allowed just two meetings with his lawyer since his capture in December of 2003. And President Bush's approval ratings dipped to the lowest point since the Associated Press began its poll in December 2003. Only 43% of adults said they approve the job being done by Bush, and just 41% say they support his handling of the war in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The indigenous-led rebellion in Latin America's poorest country, Bolivia, has taken yet another dramatic turn. After a tense day and rumors of coup plots and possible civil war, Bolivia has a new president. The Bolivian Congress named Supreme Court Chief Eduardo Rodriguez to replace Carlos Mesa, who resigned earlier this week amid massive protest. Rodriguez is president of the Supreme Court. He has a master's degree in public administration from Harvard University. After being sworn in, he called for general elections. While he didn't set a date for the polls, the Constitution stipulates new elections must be held within 6 months. Congress endorsed Rodriguez after accepting the resignation of Carlos Mesa. Hours earlier, the president of the Bolivian Senate, Armando Vaca Diaz, announced he would not seek to assume the presidency.
Porque se acaben las confrontaciones.
For the unity of our country, so that the clashes end,
Bolivia recupere su normalidad.
So that Bolivia can recover its normality, and so that the experience we've lived through in our country may never be repeated,
sea repetida, renuncio.
I resign the succession as mandated by Article 93 of the State Political Constitution.
De la Constitución Política del Estado.
Vaca Diaz made the announcement after protesters blockaded Parliament to prevent his appointment. Rodriguez assumed the presidency after the head of the lower house of Congress also declined the post. The country's airports were shut down after air traffic controllers started a strike to oppose Vaca Diaz. Congress met in Sucre instead of its headquarters in La Paz to try to avoid massive indigenous-led protests, but the demonstrators followed them. Security forces had tried to seal off Sucre from demonstrators, but they got through and battled police in the downtown area. Protesters took over three oil fields belonging to British Petroleum and four belonging to Spain's Repsol. They have also taken over a pipeline station on the border with Chile. At the request of the government, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan dispatched a senior official to Bolivia to act as an observer. The mainly peaceful protests turned violent when Coro Meta, a minor union leader, was shot dead by a soldier near Sucre. This is opposition leader Evo Morales.
What's happened in Bolivia is unfortunate. Because of Armando Vaca Diaz, president of Congress, we've lost the life of a comrade like Carlos Coro. It's unfortunate because despite everything, the attitude of Mr. Armando Vaca Diaz doesn't change.
Immediately after Rodriguez assumed power, Morales urged him to promise to nationalize the oil and gas industry and to convene a constitutional assembly At the request of the government, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan dispatched a senior official to Bolivia. We're joined now in our studio in Phoenix by Marcela Oliveira. She is a Bolivian researcher and activist who works at the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, a member of the Coalition in Defense of Water and Life that organized a popular uprising against the privatization of the Cochabamba water system by Bechtel and the World Bank. Last year, she worked with Public Citizen in Washington to develop an inter-American water activist network. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Marcela.
Thank you very much, Annie.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest developments of the last 24 hours?
Well, as you mentioned before, there is a new president right now in Bolivia, and but the main problems there are not solved. The demands of the people since the beginning were the nationalization of the gas, the natural resources, and a new kind of government that could allow the people participate. And we are thinking that we could do this through an assembly, constituent assembly. And those are the main demands of the people. Until those two things could be possible, I don't think it's going to be a solution for the problems that we have right now there.
Well, can you talk about this succession from Mesa to the head of the Bolivian Senate, who looked like he was going to take power, Vaca Diaz, and then ultimately did not, and then ultimately who this head of the Bolivian Supreme Court is?
Well, Armando Vaca Diaz, and the Constitution says that the next person to be a president should be Armando Vaca Diaz, that is the head of the Senate, and the and if he will resign, the next person will be the head of the deputies. Both person resign because both are linked to this old oligarchy of politicians that are still in power and those guys that cause all the problems that we have right now in Bolivia. You know, those traditional political parties who Bolivian people don't believe them anymore, you know, who cause all the disaster that we are living right now. So that's why people demanded the resignation of these two guys. And a guy who apparently is not linked to any political party could assume the presidency and could lead toward a solution in our country. Armando Vaca Diaz is also a guy who comes from the richest part of our country, that is Santa Cruz, and which the last months are been asking for an autonomous government that could allow them to be exploiting more our natural resources in favor of the transnationals. That's why people mainly said we don't want these guys because they belong to these political parties that sold our country to the transnationals. But at the same time, I don't think, once more I have to say this, that those were not the main demands of the people.
We're also joined on the line from Cochabamba, Bolivia, by Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center, who writes a blog on Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. Jim Schultz, you were out in the streets yesterday in Cochabamba. Can you talk about what was happening there?
Yeah. First, Amy, let me just thank you for having Marcela and I on, and to say that we've dealt with journalists all over the world the last few weeks, and Democracy Now! has analyzed the story better and more consistently than anybody. I just want to say that, and thank you. Yesterday was an unbelievably tense day in the country, in Cochabamba as well. I mean, last night, people were preparing for where they were going to sleep away from their homes in fear of a coup. Vaca Diaz had directly threatened, in comments to the BBC and elsewhere, military action as soon as he took office. So we had no idea what was going to happen yesterday, and the people were amazing. There were 3,000 to 4,000 people in the plaza here in Cochabamba yesterday in a giant march and rally to demand that Vaca Diaz not assume the presidency. to demand the nationalization of the country's gas and oil, and to demand this Constituent Assembly to rewrite the Constitution. The police tear gassed all of us who were in that plaza. There's also a group here, including the mayor and others, who have gone on a hunger strike to press those same demands. This was a very tense day in Cochabamba and around the country. I mean, imagine the spectacle of the Congress having to move to another city because the Capitol was shut down, only to find miners coming in. And at one point, the Congress decided not to meet and tried to leave, and the miners shut down the airport in Sucre. The people here are speaking in an extraordinarily loud voice in the streets. And as Marcella pointed out, this is not over, because the demands that sent people into the streets beginning 3 weeks ago was never just, we want a new president. The demand has consistently been, we want the country to renationalize the gas and oil, and we want this Constituent Assembly to rewrite the Constitution. And so while the country, I think, is less tense this morning because we've been relieved of the possibility of this potential dictator essentially coming in and taking over, these two demands are still the demands from the street, and I don't think you're going to see a let-up in the pressure until we see some sort of commitment by the government, some sort of an agreement that those two issues are going to be resolved in one way or another.
We're talking to Jim Schultz in Cochabamba, Bolivia, where there was also mass protest yesterday. Marcella Oliveira joins us in a studio in Phoenix. She lives in Cochabamba, Bolivia. We're going to break, and when we come back, in addition to our two guests in Arizona and Bolivia, we'll be joined by former California State Senator Tom Hayden, who has spent a good deal amount of time in Bolivia and has looked at the team from the U.S. of Clinton campaign meisters who went down to Bolivia a while ago that saw the beginning of this succession of Bolivian presidents. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, on public access TV stations and PBS, as well as on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV as well, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and our headlines are now translated into Spanish, in audio files as well as transcript at our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our discussion. The latest dramatic developments in Bolivia, the head of the Supreme Court has now just been sworn in as president with indigenous protesters and mass rebellion around the country protesting the man who would have constitutionally succeeded President Mesa and and he was the head of the Senate, Vaca Diaz. And we're talking about how this has happened and where the struggle goes from here. Our guest, Marcela Oliveira, in the studio in Phoenix with the Democracy Center in Cochabamba. In Cochabamba, Jim Schultz is with us with that center. And in our studio in New York, we're joined by Tom Hayden, former California state senator, traveled to Bolivia last year, interviewed Evo Morales, who was the head of the coca growers, now a socialist Congress member, wrote an article for The Nation magazine entitled Bolivia's in Indian Revolt. And we welcome you as well, Tom Hayden. I think some people might be surprised that we're having you in to talk about Bolivia. But why do you think Bolivia is so important right now?
Well, I think progressives really need to pay attention to Bolivia. It's kind of an epicenter of several struggles. One, it's the only place in Latin America or the world where the left is led by Indian leadership, people like Evo Morales and others. Two, it was the poster child for the Clinton project, so-called neoliberalism, stripping the social benefits out of the economy to make it a place for investment, particularly British Petroleum, Sempra, Enron was in there, and it's a disaster area. It's now 70% poverty, as Jim Schultz and the other good people there can tell you. And Evo Morales, in the spectrum of Bolivian politics, is described by many of the experts I talk to as a moderate pragmatist. He's not just a leader in the streets. He actually favors a kind of New Deal nationalization of the oil industry, the kind of thing that happened to Mexico in the 1930s. There are other far more radical people who want to go from a country that has an Indian majority to a country that is reconfigured as an Indian republic. There are people on the other side who want a coup. It may be that none of these happens, no coup, no radical reform, no Indian republic, and it just is patched together, in which case it would be really tragic. You have a weakened state with the Santa Cruz people, as your friend from Phoenix indicated, being kind of a white, rich, oil-producing sector seeking autonomy, secession, and the Indian majority thwarted by the rules of the game in terms of coming to power electorally, although we'll see, it's possible, and this constant turmoil in the streets that threatens the state but never quite transforms it. This oil and gas issue may bring it all together and may create a revolutionary situation, but it may just continue, as it has for several years, to be constant siege by the Indians against the state with no fundamental change.
I want to read to you a press release from GQR, Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research, Inc. It says, GQR with James Carville, Shrum Divine Donilon, and GCS UK helps elect Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. It says, the former Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada pulled off a remarkable electoral comeback by finishing first in Bolivia's presidential elections on June 30th. Of course, this was a few years ago.
96,
Sanchez de Lozada, who served as president from 93 to 97, trailed by more than 10 points in the 11-candidate field with less than 1 month to go in the campaign, according to public opinion polls. Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research served as Sanchez de Lozada's consultant on polling and strategy, helped develop Sanchez de Lozada's winning campaign message, which stressed solving Bolivia's economic crisis by creating public works and jobs. And then it goes to talk about the victory. It says GQR worked for Sanchez de Lozada, or Goni as he's called, as part of the GCS Consortium of Campaign Consultants. GCS includes political strategist James Carville from the media firm Shrum Divine Donilon. And it goes on from there. It's can you talk about, I mean, we're talking about the Clinton campaign team. What were they doing in Bolivia?
Well, you explained it precisely. The Clinton campaign team branched out, so to speak. They were with the more corporate candidates in Argentina, in Mexico as well. But in Bolivia, they took particular credit for the election of this fellow who's known infamously as Goni, who was part of that white elite, and he was run out of the country in 2003 after his forces had killed at least 100 people in the streets. I heard about it. I was sitting at Harvard's Institute of Politics, and his friends called up from Miami and asked if he could, you know, get an appointment there. And somebody did a quick check and said, well, he just killed 100 people this month. Let's put that off. And I don't know what happened with it. But the story is true that the Clinton group not only represented Goni and were proud of it. I talked to Stan Greenberg last year, and he said he still has a lot of respect for him. But also that same campaign firm represents British Petroleum. They say only on environmental issues, but I mean...
Jim Schultz and Cochabamba, Goni, as he's called, the former Bolivian president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, supported Vacadillas taking over. So he's very relevant to today's politics, very much a part of that oligarchy. Can you talk about the significance of this? Jim Schultz.
Let me comment briefly, and I'd like to have Marcella actually comment on that. To get a real Bolivian perspective, but Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada was the architect of all of these privatizations in partnership with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. He was sort of their local instrument. And now that those policies are in such disrepute and are really very much at the center of the uprisings here, I think that his name is poison, and they're, you know, when people think of Goni these days, what they think of is how they're going to put the guy on trial for all the people who died under his presidency. But beyond that, I think it would be good to have Marcella's perspective.
Marcella, if you could comment on that, I also wanted to go back in time and have you describe what actually happened in Cochabamba a few years ago when you took on Bechtel. But start off with the support of a sort of democratic core, democratic elite in this country supporting the election of a man who was not popular at the time, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, though he won and remains a key figure in Bolivian politics.
Well, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada is a very symbolic person for us because he represents all the policies that come that were coming to my country from the World Bank and the IMF. You know, he's the guy who sold for us all our companies or the state companies, who sold the natural resources, who killed people on the streets without any feeling about that. So this guy represents for us the model that has been imposed in Bolivia and other Latin American countries. I think when people kicked him out from our country, we were feeling that we were kicking out all these policies too. But at the same time, you know, even thinking that this guy is a symbolic guy for us, I don't think that the angriness of the people are focused on just one person. I think it's all the political parties in our country that we're doing. Don't matter who is in power, you know, who political power is running the country, you know, the policies that come from them are exactly the same. The names change, but the policies are exactly the same. So it's all these political parties that belong to this old oligarchy in Bolivia, and it's all the angriness of the people are against them. It's not just one person or one political party in singular. It's all of them, and I think that was perfectly reflected on the streets these weeks in Bolivia.
Marcella, you and your brother Oscar Oliveira are both very well known for your activism against privatization of the Cochabamba water supply by the San Francisco-based company Bechtel and the World Bank. Can you talk about that struggle as a seminal moment and what happened, the number of people who died, how you took on the major financial institutions and corporations?
Well, Amy, what happened there, it was, you know, the media's here in the United States, but also in Bolivia, tend to create those leaders, you know, those who, like Evo Morales or Oscar at some point, that And they think that people just follow these guys. I don't think it's like that. You know, I think it's, we saw a little bit in April 2000 in Bolivia when people went to the streets. It was a self call. It was a self-organization. It wasn't one leader calling to the people to join. It was just people organizing themselves. And that's something that I think that we can't understand if we are not in the middle of the struggle. So what happened in Bolivia in April 2000 was that it was just the people getting angry and some spokespersons talking for the people. And what's going on these days, you know, after April 2000, it's in all these years, you know, in happened the same the past year, and it's going on right now. It's the same, exactly the same. It's not Evo Morales that is organizing this thing. It's not Oscar Oliveira in April 2000. It's just people that can't live anymore with the same policies and are going to the streets because they don't have anything else to lose.
It's
very, very important to understand this point.
In 2000, the Bolivian police, military opened fire, right? How many people did they kill as you fought against privatization?
It was just, it was a young kid, a 17-year-old kid, called Victor Hugo Daza, who died in Cochabamba, but there were at least four people more that died in other parts of the country. But related to the water issue in that time, it was this kid in Cochabamba.
And now this Harvard-trained Supreme Court justice who is president, you've got this number of issues. One is privatization or nationalization of oil and gas. The other, the issue of indigenous rights. But they are together but also separate. Why?
I don't think what we were watching all these years, you know, and that's again goes to the to April 2000 and with the water issues, that we realize that we can't give a solution to the problems, that those problems that we have, you know, like the water problem, we couldn't give a complete solution to that problem in Bolivia. And then it was the coca issue, and then it was the health and education privatization, and now it's the gas issue again. What we see is that we can't put like sticks on that, you know. We have to resolve this, a big problem here. It's not giving small solutions to the water, to gas. It's not like that, like we are going to resolve the problem. It's a structural solution that we have to find. And I think what people are focusing right now is in this constituent assembly. I think it's that's when where we are going to find a solution for all these issues that right now are calling our attention, you know, like the water, like gas, like natural resources. I think it's in this rewriting a new constitution and building a new kind of country where we are going to find solutions to our these problems.
Jim Schultz in Cochabamba, my colleague Mario Murillo of Pacific Station WBAI this morning was quoting the Amnesty International report that talked about the war on terror now being the Amnesty report talking about it as a source of human rights abuses, used as a way to justify human rights abuses. And the idea that it is spreading to Latin America and will be used to criminalize indigenous movements as they challenge the status quo to equate indigenous with terrorists. Are you seeing that happening?
Well, you know, the United States and its allies here have a long track record of trying to figure out some way to label what happens here as anything other than what it is. I remember in 2000 during the water war, we had the president's spokesperson saying to the foreign press and everybody buying it, "Oh, this was being led by narco traffickers." So that was supposedly really a terrorist uprising, as opposed to people just being ticked off that Bechtel raised their water rates. This week, the chief American diplomat or U.S. diplomat for Latin America, Roger Noriega, tried to say that what was going on in Bolivia was really just infiltration by Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. You know, the United States in particular is obviously not really very happy about the fact that the Bolivian people are uprising and challenging the policies that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have imposed on this country. And they're going to try to paint this as anything other than what it is. And when listeners and others start hearing that somehow this is terrorist activity, it's just baloney. It's just baloney. Now, if the United States wants to force Bolivia to a point where people start blowing up oil refineries and pipelines because they've gotten to that point of desperation, the United States certainly has the capability of doing that. I think the United States' military option in Bolivia was named Ormando Baca Diaz, and it failed last night because the people basically shut down the Congress because that was being attempted. So this is absolutely a risk. The United States is trying to paint the progressive movement in Bolivia as a terrorist movement, as a narco-traffic movement. It wasn't true in 2000. It's not true now. But it is absolutely something that people need to be watchful about.
Tom Hayden, last word.
Well, the head of the U.S. Southern Command testified before Congress along those very lines that Jim has indicated, that that it could become a narco state. So they are trying to paint it. Everything is on the line here. You have an Indian-led revolutionary movement that is unprecedented. You have Evo Morales, the head of the coca growers union. The United States has eradicated, I think, 40,000 hectares of cocoa down to about 5,000 acres now. There's no program to really support all of those indigenous people. You have the collapse of the negotiations over gas and oil. You have these big multinational corporations on the run. You have the failure, the naked failure of what were originally the Clinton policies, or originally the Bush policies, then the Clinton policies, then the Bush policies, which are still going on. The Congress is still debating whether these policies should be applied to Central America. The CAFTA vote is still coming up. You have the FTA, the expansion to all of Latin America, at stake here. So much is at stake in Bolivia. It could be just a caretaker government, a Band-Aid temporarily. This new guy is thought of as another Mesa, kind of a moderate, compared to the Vaca Diaz that could have been a coup last night. But where's the leadership on these issues? Where's the leadership from the Democratic and Republican parties? We got them into this mess with our fine abstractions about free trade, and before that, 600 years of suppressing Indians. So when are we going to start making things right?
Well, on that note, and having raised the issue of CAFTA, we're going to turn now to a debate on the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Tom Hayden, I want to thank you for being with us. Jim Schultz and Cochabamba, and as well, Marcela Oliveira, speaking to us from Phoenix, based, though, in Cochabamba, Bolivia. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on CAFTA. Stay with us.
Joan Soriano. Yo sé cómo hacerlo. La pedantería era tu lema, como yo quería, tú me humillabas. La pedantería era tu lema, como yo quería, tú me humillabas. Tú te sentías tenerlo todo, dice la dueña del universo. Tú te sentías tenerlo todo, dice la dueña del universo. Pero mira, tú lo has cambiado, mira cómo todo ha cambiado. Ahora quien ríe soy yo. Ahora quien sabe soy yo. ¿Sabes?
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has made passage of the U.S.-Dominican Republic and Central American Free Trade Agreement, known as CAFTA, among his top priorities this year. Like NAFTA did for the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, the trade agreement would end most tariffs and port restrictions on trade between the U.S. and six Latin American countries, Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. CAFTA is scheduled to be considered by the Senate Finance Committee next week, and the House may vote on it in the next month. President Bush has intensified his campaign to pass the agreement in the last week, has met with Democrats in Congress to convince them to support CAFTA, and yesterday, in an attempt to shore up votes for the pact, administration pledged to devote more money to improving labor rights in Central America. So far, only four Democrats have announced their support for CAFTA. Monday, in a speech to the Organization of American States, Bush linked CAFTA to his broader hemispheric agenda. He said, quote, "When people throughout the Americas see their lives improve and opportunity more abundant, their faith in democracy will grow and our hemisphere will be more secure." However, opposition to CAFTA has come from an array of business and labor groups. Critics of the agreement say it doesn't provide enough protection for the environment and workers and could worsen the trade deficit. Opponents in Central America are concerned CAFTA could hurt small farmers and lead to privatization of public services. Today, a debate on CAFTA. We're joined in our studio by Charles Kernighan. He is the director of the National Labor Committee. We're also joined on the telephone by Dr. Carlos Siqueira. He is the chief CAFTA negotiator for Nicaragua. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I'd like to begin with Carlos Siqueira. Why do you think CAFTA is good?
Well, generally speaking, there is a very fair amount of evidence everywhere in the world that trade enhances freedom and enhances prosperity for all parties involved. That evidence has been built up since the times of Marco Polo and can be found everywhere, anywhere in time. I think we cannot fight history. We cannot fight a phenomenon that is happening, which is called globalization. And instead of fighting the unavoidable, the best thing to do is to embrace it in order to gain benefits for all parties involved, particularly when we are talking about improving the conditions for people that have been living in poverty for centuries.
Charlie Kernighan, your response.
Well, actually, what's happening is that the workers tell us they're going backwards. Their wages are going down over the last two or three years. They're sinking deeper into misery, deeper into poverty. Their rights are being violated every single day. For example, there's a large auto parts manufacturer in Nicaragua, a company called Arnicom. It's a Japanese-Mexican conglomerate making wire harnessing systems for Ford, for Toyota, and Nissan, sent to the United States. 5,000 workers. Plant opened about two and a half years ago. The workers were promised $50 a week as a wage, told it would be a good job. They actually got 44 cents an hour, $21 and 21 cents a week. Starvation wages, can't live on that. To get the job, you had to take mandatory pregnancy tests. The workers speak about excessive heat in the factory, excessive production goals, 1,000 pieces an hour. Its conditions were so bad in this high-tech factory that on February 3rd, the workers went on a spontaneous walkout. All workers in three different factories went out on strike. They stayed out for 2.5 days. They occupied the factory, no food, no water. Out of that struggle, they won a 3-cent wage increase to 47 cents an hour. They're still broken. 47 cents an hour, $22.73 a week. And what happened was the workers tried to organize a union. The company formed a yellow union. The workers came back and tried to organize an independent union on May 29th. May 31, three of the union leaders were fired, and now they're fighting for reinstatement. So what we're seeing is that CAFTA is leaving behind workers, leaving behind wages, leaving behind worker rights. It'll just leave, it'll nail in place the mandatory pregnancy test, the forced overtime, the lack of respect, their security guards in the factory. If a worker even leans against the wall, they're on their feet 8 to 9 hours a day. A worker even leans against the wall, the guards come over and poke them and make them get up. In other words, it's going to leave behind the workers. This is why they oppose it.
Carlos Siqueira, your response.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity because this is a great example of how to reflect on things that are not accurate at all in order to make a statement. I am reading now that last night there was a tremendous shooting in the city of Detroit. And if you look at the statistics, there is a shooting in the city of Detroit every single evening. Can I generalize based on that you cannot go to Detroit because you would be exposed to crossfire? I think that is not correct. I think there is an agreement everywhere among intellectual people that you cannot generalize based on specifics. You have to look at general trends, at general conditions. There are companies that violate rights of labor, and there are companies that honor rights of labor. We have in Nicaragua, since my opponent mentioned my own country, we have to create 2.5 million new jobs in the next 15 years because we have to provide opportunities to people that are not just a statistical trend, but people who are already born or have a name and a last name. We have to provide it, and in order to that, we have to attract direct foreign investment. We have been able to develop new jobs, to open new plants, to create new positions for people who need a job.
What about protection of human rights and labor rights?
I beg your pardon?
What about protection of labor rights?
I think labor conditions can be improved. By definition, can be improved anywhere. In Nicaragua, the United States, or Vatican City, by definition. But I think that CAFTA precisely provides the incentives and the means to make that improvement. So instead of putting those rights backward, I think provides the opportunity to make a serious improvement.
Charles Carnahan.
Well, I mean, I think it's very important to pay attention to specifics because that's where the facts are. And there was another factory in Nicaragua called King Young, and it was miserable conditions. They were producing clothing for Walmart. They were getting 9 cents for every Walmart garment they sewed, 15-hour work shifts, again, the pregnancy test, excessive heat, workers being yelled at, screamed at, beaten. The workers tried to organize. March 22, 2004, and 3 days later, the firing started. And eventually 400 workers were fired. And at this point, the Ministry of Labor actually tried to do the right thing in Nicaragua, and they called for the reinstatement of the fired union leaders who were legally elected. And the company just said to them, not this union. We're never taking them workers back. The Ministry of Labor cited the company for excessive overtime. And the company actually responded to the Ministry of Labor, you only think they're working overtime. They're actually socializing the factory. They like it so much they stay at night and they talk to each other. That's why they're checking out late. It's idiotic. There is no respect for worker rights, no respect for human rights. CAFTA, as it stands, it just says to the governments, you should enforce your labor laws. It doesn't even bring those labor laws into compliance with ILO standards.
What's ILO?
The International Labor Organization, the UN, which has set internationally recognized worker rights standards, like freedom of association, right to organize. It doesn't even bring these countries' labor codes into compliance with these international standards. And on top of it, the enabling legislation in these countries it doesn't protect any of the rights that they even have in their labor laws. This is why the workers have rejected it. This is why the unions in Central America are opposed to it, fighting it. This is why the solidarity groups are opposed to it. The small farmers are opposed to it.
Why are some Republicans and companies here opposed to it?
Oh, well, I mean, it's in Nicaragua, for example, since it is a very tragically poor country, there's a special agreement to allow Nicaragua to use 640 square million yards of fabric from outside the CAFTA region. And so those garments will come into the United States duty-free. 427 million garments with fabric made in China. So we've already lost 440,000 apparel jobs and textile jobs in the United States since George Bush came to office. There's maybe about 600,000 jobs left. There are real problems with the way the CAFTA is set up because there's no level playing field. There's no respect for worker rights. Like the gentleman said, the jobs in Nicaragua have increased. In fact, they've quadrupled. Between 1998 and 2004, the maquiladora jobs went from 15,000 to over 61,000. There's 77 maquila factories in Honduras, in Nicaragua right now. In terms of apparel, it's booming. Between 2003 and 2004, apparel exports were up 23%. They're up 50% in the first 2 months of 2005. Everything's going up. The only thing that's gone down is wages and worker rights. So why should the workers in Nicaragua, or the workers in the United States, for that matter, buy into a trade agreement which is meant for business?
like Bill Thomas at the House Ways and Means Committee trying to push this through, trying to push Congress, COFTA through Congress. The other day, he told the real reason. He said, look, the U.S. companies need access to cheap wages in nearby countries. This is what's going on.
Carlos Sequeira, your response to that. The U.S. companies need access to cheap labor.
It's interesting that he refers to two Asian companies. I would like to invite him to calm down and talk to American companies that are basing them here, even companies from the Carolinas. There is a reality. Your economy, the American economy, is migrating, as it has always done, to face prosperity. You started as an agricultural economy, then you move into manufacturing, then into services, and now you are in the knowledge economy. Jobs have to be transformed. Jobs have to be re-engineered. You have to convert people and people's skills to order to face. There is a reality. You are going to be facing certain jobs, and you are going to be losing them to China, and that is a fact you don't refer to. My question is, if you are going to lose jobs because you have to recombine them in more value-added jobs, and it's the case in the United States, to whom you want to lose them? To a country that is remote and doesn't buy American as China, or you prefer to give them to your backyard countries, to your friends and neighbors who are badly in need of creating new jobs and that buy American?
Charlie Kernighan.
Well, two quick points. I would be very glad to come to Nicaragua to see these factories, except the government won't let me into the country. They've declared me a person non grata. So that's a possibility for human rights work. I mean, it's obviously uncomfortable for them and not convenient. So that's an impossibility. But what we're actually seeing is jobs are leaving Mexico under NAFTA. The workers are now worse off than they've ever been. Same thing. The wages are going down. 87 cents an hour for auto parts workers in Mexico. The highest wage in the country that we saw for auto parts workers was $2.47. Those jobs are now leaving for Honduras and Nicaragua. And in Mexico, Alcoa, very big producer of auto parts, is telling the workers in Mexico, hey, we can hire 3 Hondurans for every one of you Mexicans. So now they're pitting Mexico against Honduras. And Honduras, like I said, the wages were about 80 cents an hour. In Honduras, about 80 cents an hour, $22.73 a week. Now, $35 a week. Now, Nicaragua has these 44 cent an hour wages, and so they're cannibalizing each other. It's a race to the bottom.
What about China?
China is a huge problem. In Honduras, for example, in a factory called Paraiso, we were just on the phone with people yesterday regarding this, they make clothing for Walmart, for Kohl's, for Walt Disney, T-shirts. In 1996, the workers went on a 20-day strike. They took over the streets. They tried to organize, improve conditions in that factory. They won. But then the company eventually wore them down, fired all of the union people. They came back again in 1999. They won again. They have 3 contracts signed over time with this factory. Well, the factory's closing because those T-shirts are going to China.
I want to ask you one quick thing before we wrap up, and that is this week the announcement of 25,000 GM workers going to be laid off. Do you see this? How do you see this in the context of CAFTA? Does it relate in any way?
Yeah, well, CAFTA is definitely part of the race to the bottom. I mean, and it's definitely related to China, and it's definitely related to the free trade agreement in the Americas. In other words, this is going to nail in place the race to the bottom. It's very weak labor protections, no wage protections. There's no level playing field for workers in the United States, workers in Central America. It's a bad deal. And if the American people had a clue as to what's going on, it would be rejected. Interesting to say, when negotiators tried to pick up the property rights, a company's trademarks in their labels, they demanded that the countries bring up their intellectual property rights standards to WTO, World Trade Organization standards, and even exceed those standards. And they put all sorts of compliance regulations and sanctions and everything. When it comes to worker rights, you know, it's the same old game. You know, it's a step back for the workers.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it, but it's a discussion we will continue to have. I want to thank Carlos Sequeira for joining us. CAFTA negotiator for Nicaragua, professor at NK Business School, Harvard-affiliated business school in Nicaragua, and Charlie Kernighan of the National Labor Committee based in New York. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can get our headlines, transcripts, and listen to and watch our show. A very special happy birthday to Chris Zucker. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.